American politics may never be the same. On To the Point, we help you understand the trends driving this wild and woolly election.
Donald Trump has had nothing but wonderful things to say about all variety of dictators and thugs around the world.
Our system of politics right now is so incredibly corrupt.
The sense of nostalgia for a kind of lost cultural world and real anxiety about its passing, I think, is fueling, you know, much of what we're seeing.
I'm Armin Alney. Stay with To the Point through November and beyond on KCRW and KCRW.com.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's go!
Donald Trump is making his pitch to black voters, or his pitch about them at any rate. He also said there might be a softening of his immigration position, but he couldn't quite explain what would become of 11 million unauthorized immigrants. And Hillary Clinton gave a speech tying Trump to his fringe white nationalist fans. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the left is Jon Favreau, former speechwriter for President Obama and co-host of the podcast Keeping It 1600. On the right is J.D. Vance, author of the new best-selling memoir Hillbilly Elegy. And our special guest is Kelly Goff, columnist for The Daily Beast and host of the WNYC series Political Party with Kelly Goff. Welcome, everybody. So, Kelly, on August 15th, you wrote a column called Why African Americans Loathe Donald Trump, discussing Trump's pathetic standing at 2% in the polls with black voters, putting him in fourth place in the four-way race with Jill Stein and Gary Johnson. Your column has proved timely, since this has been the week Trump has chosen to make what is nominally his pitch for the black vote.
I say it again. What do you have to lose? Look, what do you have to lose? You're living in poverty. Your schools are no good. You have no jobs. 58% of your youth is unemployed. What the hell do you have to lose? And at the end of 4 years, I guarantee you that I will get over 95% of the African American vote. I promise you.
So, what do you make of that? Can you keep that promise?
Well, for starters, to answer his question, what do we have to lose, speaking of someone who's African-American, I'd say the answer is quite a lot. And I think that Hillary Clinton's campaign actually showed that in a really effective way with their new ad, tying Trump to all of the white supremacist and white nationalists and Klan members who are very excited about his candidacy. You know, I want to go on the record and say that I do not believe that every person who's supporting Donald Trump is a racist. But I also want to go on the record and say that lots of racists have signed up to support Donald Trump. And there is, which is something that's, I think, scary for a lot of people of color. But I want to say that just to speak to how scary Donald Trump's candidacy specifically is to a lot of people of color, one of the things I pointed out in my column is not only is he polling at the back of the pack among all of the presidential candidates, he's polling behind David Duke, an actual Klansman. That's how afraid many people of color are of a Donald Trump presidency, that they say, look, I trust the guy who used to wear a Klan robe more, because at least he's honest about his racism, than the guy running for president who says, what do you have to lose?
So the thing that I've found remarkable this week, as Trump has used this line over and over again at various different rallies in different states, almost always in front of mostly white audiences, is this pitch is condescending, it's reductive, it's ignorant, but it's very similar in a way to the pitch that he's been making to whites for more than a year, which is basically, your life is a disaster, these idiots you elected have failed you, I can fix it. Come with me.
You can't do any worse.
Right. And the thing about him making that pitch to whites for over a year, it's also reductive and ignorant and condescending as regards whites. And yet it seems to have appealed to a lot of them. And JD, I want to ask you about that. Part of, I think, what has made people so interested in your book, which is fantastic, by the way, is sort of what insight it gives into what has drawn so much of the white working class to Donald Trump. Why, basically, a pitch so similar to this pitch to black voters that's getting laughed at, why has it worked with so much of white America?
Well, maybe the reason it's working is that they haven't heard a pitch like that in a long time, whereas a lot of black voters have heard that pitch for 20, 30, 40 years, and it hasn't come from very kind or hospitable people. So I think that there's this really low bar in the white working class. There's this recognition that things aren't working. And what they really want most of all is someone who recognizes that. But it almost doesn't matter in what form it takes because nobody else has really tried for a long time.
John, one thing that I've been hearing a lot of people say about what Trump has been saying about black voters this week is that it's really for whites. That basically he's trying to convince white voters that he's not too racist to vote for. And that's the audience for this. And I guess my questions are, do you think that's what he's up to here? And do you think that this approach is likely to work at all in that regard?
I'm sure it's what he's up to. I don't think it will work in any way unless all the white voters he's trying to appeal to come down with a case of mass collective amnesia. You know, I mean, I think that's the test in the next 70 days here. It's like, you could go through his Twitter feed in about 10 seconds and find, I don't know, five or six tweets that are deeply racially offensive, you know? And so I think that what the problem Trump has is, and you saw this in Hillary's speech, which I'm sure we're going to get to, is, you know, all you have to do is repeat back Donald Trump's own words to remind people of what he said in the past, and they realize that he's not going to change.
But, it's interesting, though. I just read an interview with Tom Metzger, who's probably one of the most famous white supremacists in history in our country. Not exactly a title I would want someone to be proud of, but that's really who he is. And he was saying that hiring Steve Bannon from Breitbart, Trump's appeals this week, it's really not about going for the white separatist vote, because he said that's a fairly small voter demographic. That's what Tom Metzger said. He said, but there are a lot of closeted racists. That's actually a pretty substantial part of the white vote, which I thought was interesting to hear him say. And what he meant by that is he said it's the people who do not want to be publicly identified as racist, but would completely freak out if their daughter married a black guy. And he said those are the people that Trump is really trying to reach. And there are a lot of them. And so I think that that's a really interesting analysis when we're talking about this speech in comparison to the tweets that John mentioned, that I think there are more people in this country who actually aren't as troubled by some of his tweets as those of us sitting here in the studio are. And that's, I think, the people he's talking to.
I feel like when people talk about the, you know, how much is racism behind Donald Trump's support, people talk about this dichotomy, you know, voters who are for Donald Trump for reasons that are about racism and voters who are for Trump for other reasons. And I wonder if that's a false dichotomy. Mm-hmm. I don't know. JD, do you have thoughts on how big the role is that racial issues are playing in drawing support to Donald Trump? Is the media too quick to basically describe this as principally a story about race?
Well, I think they're probably too quick just because it's fundamentally reductionist. And like you said, I think that this is probably a lot more complicated than a lot of folks give credit for. I mean, the way that I think about it is, on the one end, you have someone like Martin Luther King, who's extraordinarily magnanimous to people that he shouldn't be magnanimous towards, or of course was. And on the other hand, you have like David Duke. And I think most people fall somewhere in the middle. And it's, you know, as Kelly said, it's not just the people who are outwardly racist or even the people who are somewhat racist but are afraid to talk about it. There's also a pretty significant chunk of the population, people who don't even recognize that they're racist but maybe harbor some sensitivities or anxieties about race. And Trump is really, he's not just appealing to them, but I think in some ways he's actually drawing them out and drawing them to think about things in a different way. And that's what's really, frankly, worrisome to me, is that he's not just exploiting the racism that's there. He seems to be actually heightening racial anxiety and turning it into something that it wasn't before.
Because it's worth noting that the Southern Poverty Law Center, there had actually been a dip in the number of hate groups and the rise in membership after hitting its peak, really, in President Obama's first year. It was starting to dip about 2.5 years ago, and they've started to see those numbers spike up since Trump's candidacy began.
Sorry, this is JD. I think that's a really interesting statistic, and I think it speaks to the fact that political leadership does actually matter. It's not just that people are, they don't just exist in this vacuum where they lead the politicians. The politicians also lead them, and we should ask questions about whether where Donald Trump is leading people is dangerous and ultimately very dark.
Turning off that, why don't we take a look at this speech that Hillary Clinton gave this week? Because it's basically making more or less the argument that you were making there, JD, which is that Donald Trump is not a normal Republican. This, in fact, a line she said in the speech was, "This is not a normal choice." And she described him as running a campaign that is based on prejudice and paranoia. John, I'd actually like to start with you on this. When I saw this speech, I recoiled a little bit in the sense that ordinarily I feel like Democrats feel like they need to be extremely careful about making accusations of racism because they will fear creating white backlash. But in fact, what we saw here was that Trump has gotten almost no defense after this speech from Republican politicians who you'd normally expect to sort of come out and say, "How dare you call our candidate racist?" What do you make of the way this speech has landed, and do you think it was a smart framing?
Not only did no Republicans respond, but the Trump campaign itself has not refuted any of the charges that she made in the speech, which tells you a lot, right? I mean, I think the interesting thing about that speech is, in a lot of the speeches that she's made, that President Obama's made, that other Democrats have made in this campaign season, is you don't have to put a lot of spin on the ball in these speeches. You don't have to come up with a whole bunch of fancy rhetoric or tough lines against Trump. All you have to do is read back his own words and talk about his own actions, right? And so I think that's what allows her to give a speech like that. If she had to build an argument from scratch about why Donald Trump is racist, I think everyone would recoil a little bit more. But all she did is simply read off things that he's done in the past and also gave other Republicans sort of an exit. You know, like, if you don't want to be associated with this, speak up now. And by the way, other Republican presidents and presidential candidates have in the past.
It's funny in that the speech was framed, or they previewed the speech as being about the alt-right, which is this nebulous thing. It's a movement you may not have heard of before this week. I would describe it roughly as internet savvy white supremacists, many of whom live in their parents' basements. Another thing that was in the speech was that she tied the alt-right to Breitbart.com, which is the fringe conservative website that was run by Steve Bannon, who is now running the Trump campaign. And certainly there are a lot of alt-right people who are fans of Breitbart, but there are also a lot of people who read Breitbart who are very conservative, who are not necessarily part of the alt-right. I was wondering, JD, what you think about sort of that continuum and what it means for Republicans here if Hillary's basically demarcating, you know, this segment of support that is large for Donald Trump is very scary. How does the right figure out basically what are the set of people that are too far out and what are the set of people that they need to be able to defend as a part of the reasonable discourse?
Well, I think it depends in part the ways that these websites are reacting to mainstream conservatism to begin with. If you ask most Republican politicians, they hate Breitbart not because it's part of the alt-right or because it occasionally says racist things. They hate it because it's one of the major arms in a war against effective Republican government for the past 10 or 20 years. And so it's not so much in the on the Republican side a reaction to racism as much as it is they don't like these people for their own reasons. Maybe, you know, maybe they don't like the racism of Breitbart. I think that's true for a lot of Republicans. But they also don't like the fact that Breitbart is this kind of internal firing squad. And so, again, I think it's really complicated and trying to tease out what role Breitbart should have in a future right. And it depends a lot, frankly, on what Breitbart does. I mean, the website, people like to, I think, overstate the role that Breitbart himself was a constructive part of the political conversation, but he certainly wasn't a racist and certainly wasn't appealing to the worst parts of the political conversation. Whereas under Bannon, I think it really has taken a pretty bad direction.
Okay, that's something interesting, too, is as John pointed out, there hasn't been much pushback on her speech. But interestingly enough, there has been a lot of pushback among conservatives against the ad with the featuring the hate groups.
Let's hear a little bit of that video the Clinton campaign put out with Klan members and other white supremacists talking about why they like Donald Trump.
Donald Trump would be best for the job.
For president.
Yeah.
I am a farmer and white nationalist. Support Donald Trump.
Sending out all the illegals, building a wall, and a moratorium on Islamic immigration. That's very appealing to a lot of ordinary white people.
Running against Donald Trump at this point is really treason to your heritage.
Will you unequivocally condemn David Duke and say that you don't want his vote or that of other white supremacists?
I don't know anything about white supremacists, so I don't know.
And I think that that's interesting because it gets to the heart of what we're discussing, right? Which is this fine line that they kind of want to walk, I think, in the Trump campaign, which is dog whistling to a certain element of the fringe conservative movement that they need to win without actually being seen as, you know, an actual white supremacist, which is not as easy of a tightrope act as I think they anticipated, perhaps.
Well, I guess the question is, do Republicans see, you know, what the seeds were that were laid for this? You know, the Donald Trump, before he was a Republican presidential candidate, was sort of the birther in chief out there promoting birth certificate conspiracies about Donald Trump, about President Obama, something that Republicans sort of played footsie with Donald Trump while he was doing that. And I guess the question is, after seeing the way that the party got hijacked, is there a strategy for them to contain things like Breitbart going forward, or is this not going to be seen as something as an ongoing threat that they can manage?
I think there's a bit of a line in the sand because, you know, I'm a bit of an optimist about this. I've discussed this before on your show that I actually would love it when Donald Trump said the words, you know, what do you have to lose? Look, I've said before, I don't think it's beneficial to people of color that we essentially feel like we live in a country where we have a choice between voting for a racist or voting for the other guy. I don't think that does a service to our community in terms of policy. And so I would love it to experience an election where it feels like African Americans have the same choices that, you know, white suburban soccer moms feel like they have when they go to the voting booth. And that hasn't been the case. I think, though, that perhaps after this election, if we see the Republican Party rebuild with the voices of people like Mitt Romney and the Bushes who have said, we do not stand for racism, we do not stand for bigotry, and we do not stand for the rhetoric of Donald Trump, there's a real opportunity for the Republican Party to grow into a party that receives more votes of African Americans and other people of color. There's not an opportunity for that if the Breitbart wing wins.
We have to take a break. Let us know what you think about Trump and the alt-right at kcrw.com/LRC, our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, the softening. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Jon Favreau, former speechwriter for President Obama. On the right is J.D. Vance, author of the best-selling memoir Hillbilly Elegy. And Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast and WNYC is also with us. So there was this kind of surreal moment on Wednesday. Donald Trump appeared at a town hall with Sean Hannity on Fox News, and he kept taking this live audience that they had and polling them as though by applause meter to ask what should be done with the roughly 11 million unauthorized immigrants in the United States. Should they all have to go, or should we let some of them with deep ties to the United States stay? And the audience was actually quite divided on this. It was not the, you know, hardcore throw them out audience you might have expected at a Trump town hall. And Donald Trump himself seemed to be conflicted on the issue. He said there could be a softening of his position on immigration. And he talked about what a tough thing it is to remove someone from the country who has been here for more than a decade and has family here. But the next day, he said nobody could get legal status unless they first left the country. And when he was asked specifically by Anderson Cooper whether all 11 million unauthorized immigrants would have to leave the country, he wouldn't commit. He said probably, but he wasn't sure. So I don't know what to make of this. At the beginning of the week, people had been talking about this as another pivot. The idea that Donald Trump was, for the general election, trying to come up with a position that was more acceptable to Hispanics. But it seems to me that he just came up with something that basically makes everybody upset. I don't know. Jon, can you discern a strategy here?
Here's what I think happened. Kellyanne Conway, who is now his campaign manager, is a pollster. We've known for some time that the least popular element of Trump's immigration policy was the mass deportations. It's less popular than the wall, less popular than anything else. We've seen that in polls on the Democratic side for a while. So she told him this is a problem. You're going to have to move on this. But now he's caught between the polling and Sean Hannity's audience. And Sean Hannity's audience is, you know, that's what built his campaign in the first place, you know? And so I think
that's... Well, part of Sean Hannity's audience was happy to move with him on the issue. About half of his voters in the primary had all along said that they weren't in favor of a mass deportation.
Which tells you the difference between Sean Hannity's audience and people like Sean Hannity and Ann Coulter and the people that lead that movement, right? And so there's a little bit of a disconnect that Kellyanne was probably trying to exploit there that Trump has not been able to do so deftly.
One of the things that I find funny reading immigration polling is that it almost looks to me like you can structure the poll however you want and get whatever answer you like. And a lot of people have positions that amount to we should have good immigrants and not bad immigrants. And then it's very, very nebulous what that distinction means. It has me wondering, certainly Ann Coulter is quite upset. Mark Krikorian, who runs the Hardline Center for Immigration Studies, is extremely upset. I wonder how much this is really going to upset his voters and how much the idea that he ran on immigration, how much of that was about specific hardline policies and how much of it was about a sentiment that immigration has been bad and we have too many Mexicans or something like that. JD, do you have thoughts on how this is going to land?
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think that this is going to hurt Donald Trump very much, because fundamentally his candidacy is about a symbolic middle finger to all of the people that the white working class is frustrated and angry with, and a slight policy pivot on immigration becoming slightly more sympathetic to the immigrants who are here, which is an opinion that we've talked about as reflected somewhat in the polling. I really don't think that's going to hurt him. It's funny that Ann Coulter mentioned that it was the one issue that she said was absolutely, she could not stand a pivot from Donald Trump. But I think that what she's going to find out is that the voters of the movement that she's been in some ways leading are not that hardline about immigration or anything else. What they're hardline about is that they're very angry. And so long as Donald Trump stays angry, they're going to stay with him.
Well, and the other thing, too, that I think John touched upon when he mentioned the polling is that, keep in mind, the polls have consistently showed that a strong segment of Donald Trump supporters have actually said there are certain things we know he has to say on the campaign trail that are not representative of what he believes. And I think depending on what their key issue is, they are willing to overlook what he says on other things to justify the fact that they're still going to vote for him. So they say that, oh, he said that in front of the New York Times. He doesn't really mean that. He actually means what he says on the issue that I'm supporting him on, right? Because he has to get through the primaries. He has to get through the general. So, you know, that kind of leaves a big question mark on what he actually believes.
It's so funny. And I hear that from people on opposite sides of the same issue, insisting that Donald Trump really agrees with them and the other people he's just spinning. Another interesting aspect of this is that he's actually made this immigration issue a part of his pitch to black voters and even Hispanic voters, basically saying that, you know, that immigrants compete for jobs with, especially with blacks and Hispanics, and therefore an immigration restriction position should
especially
be good for them.
Especially on his own projects.
Right. Yes, for example. But the thing I wonder about this is, stripped of all of the fact that immigration politics is really not mostly about economics, it's about racial sensitivity. If you strip all that away and focus just on the economic question, it's not a completely implausible claim to make.
No, and it actually works among some African Americans. I mean, the thing is, the polling, I haven't looked at any recently, but when I've previously written about this issue over the last couple of years, there are African Americans who do feel like, particularly when you talk about working class black men, that there are jobs that they do not get because of illegal immigrants in certain areas. So if it were coming from anyone other than Donald Trump, it might be an effective argument. But as I explained in my column, the only thing that African Americans like less than a blatant racist is one who's not a blatant racist and one who's a closeted racist, because that's actually scarier, as plenty of people in my family have said. You'd rather know where you stand with someone, and you know where you stand with someone wearing a Klan's robe. You don't know where you stand with someone wearing a suit and tie who's dog whistling.
The thing I wonder about, so we've gone through a number of these things and basically said, you know, well, this isn't going to push away his existing voters. It's not going to win over Hispanics. It's not going to win over new voters. We've seen a remarkable stability in the polls over the last month since the convention. It looks like a pretty solid 6-point lead for Hillary Clinton. And I feel like a lot of the because there's been so little policy content in this election, a lot of the sentiment drivers that have pushed people to one side or the other over a year ago remain basically in place. And I wonder, do any of you think that there's a thing out there that would be likely to move this election significantly? Or is it just that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton represent two very different sentiments about America today, and you already know which side you're on about those sentiments, and therefore you've already figured out who you're going to vote for?
I think there are two things. One would be if there really is some bomb out of WikiLeaks. I think the second thing, though, is if Donald Trump, the only thing I believe that could ever drive away Donald Trump's core audience is Donald Trump ridiculing his core audience. I think that if there were a video of some kind of leak of him making fun of working class whites, I think that could actually be extremely damaging to him in a way that him insulting minorities, insulting women has not been.
Well, JD, what do you think about that? Because I feel like throughout his appeals to that audience, he has often done things that I would think would look insulting. He went to before evangelical Christian audiences, said the Bible was his favorite book, and then demonstrated no familiarity with it, said he had never sought forgiveness from God, referred to a passage from 2 Corinthians as 2 Corinthians during his visit at Liberty University. Is there a way for him to come off as insulting to his core audience?
Not to his core audience, because I don't think that most of these people like Donald Trump that much. I think they're just angry at the other side. And so when I talk to people back home who are supporting Trump, they recognize that he's flawed. They recognize that he's a liar in various ways, that they can't trust him. But they're still going to support him because he's not part of the political establishment that they're so frustrated against. So it's really hard for me to imagine him losing his core group of supporters. But I think what's interesting is that the most important swing demographic in this election, and one thing that could go one direction or the other, is upper class or well-educated white voters. And I suspect that what Donald Trump is trying to do with his pivot on the Hispanic issue is try to bring some of those upper class, higher educated white voters back into the fold. Because if he doesn't win a majority of those voters, Hillary Clinton's going to win this thing in a landslide.
I think I talked to some pollsters and focus group people after the attack on the cons, and they said that while in their focus groups of swing voters, while people still hadn't made up their mind about Hillary Clinton yet, that was almost disqualifying for a lot of swing voters and some of the people JD was just talking about in terms of Donald Trump. So I think that was a big moment where a lot of people made up their mind for good.
John, what would you advise Hillary Clinton, assuming that she wins this election? She's going to be in this really odd position of having won probably a quite wide victory, maybe a landslide, and yet having pretty poor favorability ratings and having had the support of a lot of people who were basically just voting for her because the other candidate was so unacceptable. What do you do in that position to try to build broader support in the electorate and be able to go into a presidency with power vis-a-vis Congress and giving people the impression that you really do have majority support among the country?
I mean, Hillary Clinton has always been her most popular when she's actually in office and not running for it. You know, she surprised a lot of Republicans when she was in the Senate, who thought that she was going to be, you know, the worst thing ever. And she came in and she built bridges and got some work done. She was fairly popular as Secretary of State. I think that rhetorically, when she gets in there, she's probably going to do a lot of reaching out. I don't think that means she's going to shift on her positions, nor do I think she should, because that's part of her issue, too, right? Like, she doesn't want to be flip-flopping all over the place. But I think, you know, rhetorically trying to build bridges, trying to work with Republicans, saying she wants to reach out, looking for issues where you can find common ground, I think she'd be wise to pursue those.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Kelly Goff, it's your soapbox.
She had a good run. I think it's time for Ann Coulter to find something else to do. I think the shtick has gotten so old that she's run out of ways to shock us.
And she has a new book.
In Trump We Trust, in which she says there's nothing Trump can do that won't be forgiven except change his immigration policies. And he repaid her by changing his immigration policy the day her book came out. So I think we can all agree that, again, she had a great run, but she needs to take it to Vegas and do something else.
Jon Favreau.
So Donald Trump called Hillary Clinton a bigot yesterday, and when he was asked why she was a bigot, he couldn't reply, neither could his campaign. When Hillary Clinton said that Trump was running a racist campaign, she basically unloaded an entire Oppo research book in public. Yet the headlines today in the AP and the Washington Post and Politico were, Clinton and Trump trade racially charged barbs. So I realize that we want to make this a race and we want to have some kind of even-handedness here, but the false equivalence today is a little bit ridiculous.
J.D. Vance.
I'd like the media to think about the sort of conversation that we're going to have after Trump loses, because if the conversation is all about how these dumb racist rednecks delivered a landslide for Hillary Clinton and that they're the only reason that Donald Trump ever had any support was the racism of his supporters, then we're going to lose these people. And I think there's a big chunk of Donald Trump's movement and his electorate that can be brought back into the fold, that can be more optimistic and more hopeful about the future, but they're not going to be brought back into the fold by the people that they hate calling them racist. So we got to have a better conversation, and I hope the media takes the lead on that.
I talked last week about the Clinton Foundation, and we've gotten a little more detail on who will be able to give money to the Clinton Foundation if Hillary wins this election. Basically, you'll have to be a U.S. citizen or permanent resident or an independent foundation in the United States. And this does make me feel significantly better, because basically the set of people who will be able to give to the Clinton Foundation is similar to the set of people who can give to a super PAC. Super PACs aren't great. They create conflicts of interest, but they create conflicts of interest that are sort of within the normal scope that we expect in our American politics. So if you wouldn't ding another politician for having a super PAC, it seems okay for the Clintons to have this foundation. Now, I think they should have had these rules earlier, but better late than never, this is a step in the right direction. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank John Favreau, J.D. Vance, and Kelly Goff. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Ashleen Knutson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.